That was beautiful. Thank you for bringing that offering on our behalf. And happy feast. Hopefully, by now, we are all de-leavened. If you're not, it's too late. But here we are on this first day of Unleavened Bread. We are de-leavened. But are we unleavened? Those are different things, right? We've de-leavened. We've put the leavening out. But then the focus of these days is really on the unleavened bread and on becoming unleavened. What does that look like? What does it look like to be unleavened? It looks like a lot of things. There are, obviously, it's a very broad and wide topic that we could look at all sorts of different things. But there's one particular area I want to look at today. I want to start, though, by looking at what it means to be leavened. I want to look at some examples of leavening that Jesus Christ called out. Let's go over to Matthew chapter 16 and verse 6. Matthew chapter 16 and verse 6. Because we'll find a few different things that Jesus Christ calls out as leavened, and specific people, specific groups of people. Matthew chapter 16 and verse 6. Verse 5. Now when his disciples had come to the other side, they went across the lake. They'd forgotten to take bread. And Jesus said to them, "Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." They just had this interaction. If you look at the beginning of chapter 16 there, it says that the Pharisees and Sadducees came, and they were trying to seek a sign from him. They wanted proof from him. They wanted to see evidence from him that he was this Messiah that they were expecting. And he wasn't going to give them some special overt sign. And so he says to his disciples, "Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." So he calls out two different groups there. We heard a little bit about the Pharisees in the sermonette. And he also identifies the Sadducees as a group of people that, you know, they had their own problems. Let's turn over to Mark chapter 8. Because he says a similar thing here. But again, slightly different. Mark chapter 8 and in verse 15. Then he charged them. And this is the same occasion. Now, sometimes we'll see discrepancies in the Bible where it's like he says one thing in this book and he says another thing in this book. And critics like to say, well, you know, it can't be true because it says two different things. You know, we're getting these little excerpts of things that he said, right? And did he just utter the one sentence and then stop speaking? Or, you know, is there a longer explanation that's going on here and more conversation than we have recorded is what's likely. But here, what Mark records, he says, "Then he charged them, saying, 'Take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod.'" So he calls out the Pharisees and Herod. We'll talk about him in a little bit too. Luke 12 and verse 1. Now, let's go over to here in the book of Luke. We're going to see, again, it's this similar kind of statement. This is a different occasion, though. This is probably not the same occasion that Luke is recording. He's talking about a different thing that happened. And here, he's going to call out that same group. "In the meantime, when an innumerable multitude of people had gathered together so that they trampled one another, he began to say to his disciples, 'First of all, beware the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy.'" So he starts to identify, well, here in this section, he specifically calls out hypocrisy as the leaven of the Pharisees. But we see that he's identifying these groups and the problems that they have and saying these things are leavening. This is what leavening is. This is what leavening looks like. Now, let's talk about those groups for a second, because We don't have, when you think Pharisee, Sadducee, you think Herod, right? You hear those names and it's kind of like, well, I know those are like, those are the bad guys in the story. But, you know, his audience, the audience of the Gospels, they would have known who these people were, and they would have, it would have meant something to them to hear them called leavened, to know that those people were leavened. So let's talk about them a little bit. The Pharisees and the Sadducees, there's these, you know, these two groups, and it's kind of like, ah, they're kind of, you know, they seem at odds with each other, but they're kind of all in charge. Really, if you go back, it's a really brief history of these groups. But if you go back to the time of Ezra, right? So about 400 years before the time of Christ, the scribes and the priests, they were virtually identical. We have there's a history of the Jewish people in the time of Jesus Christ that was written back in the late 1800s, and it explains some of these things to us, that those groups, the scribes and the priests, they were virtually identical. Ezra, it calls Ezra a scribe, but you see him come in and he operates in the temple, and the priests are kind of right there alongside him. They're all sort of this one group that's operating together. But over centuries, what happened was the scribes developed into this tradition of the Pharisees, and the priests developed into this tradition of the Sadducees. The Sadducees were, well, we'll talk about them in a sec. The Pharisees, they came out of the synagogue system. So when Israel's taken captive and there's no temple, the temple's destroyed, and they're trying to figure out, well, what do we do now? They developed the synagogue system, right? It's not a temple, but it's a place where they can gather and they can worship, right? And that system still exists today. That's the tradition that the Pharisees became a part of there in Jesus Christ's time, right? That they brought with them back in Ezra's time, that they then cultivated and ran. So they were sort of the local leaders. The word Pharisee means separated. They called themselves, the term Pharisee was given to them by other people. So these are the ones who've separated themselves. They're sort of separate, right? The Pharisees called themselves, the word means neighbors. They called themselves neighbors in contrast to what they called the people of the land. So they believed that anybody who was keeping the Torah and the oral traditions that had been passed down were the true Israel, and everybody else was the people of the land. And it's a lot like the way that the word pagan just means the people of the country, right? It's sort of the rural folks is really what pagan means. And so the Pharisees kind of had that same idea that like there was the true Israel and they were the true Israel, and then there were the people of the land. Some of them descended from Abraham's seed, but not the true Israel. They saw themselves as very special. Again, they considered the Torah authoritative and the oral traditions, and they actually considered the oral traditions that had been passed down as more important than the Torah. From one of their books, this is from the Mishnah. It says, it is more culpable to teach contrary to the precepts of the scribes than contrary to the Torah itself. So they believed that their teaching had elucidated the Torah so much that was the thing that you could not go against. You could not teach against. You're probably thinking to yourself, oh, there's some scriptures where Jesus gets on them for that. Let's go look at those. Mark chapter 7, verse 8. Because you're right, this is the exact kind of thing that Jesus Christ came and preached against. He had a lot of choice words for the Pharisees. Mark chapter 7 and verse 8. For laying aside the commandment of God, you hold the tradition of men, the washing of pitchers and cups and many other such things that you do. They were trying to sort of emulate the temple worship in their own homes. Right? So they were taking temple practices and saying, well, we're all essentially like the priesthood. We're going to have these practices in our own homes. And their traditions superseded the things that God actually commanded them to do. Verse 9, and he said to them, all too well you reject the commandment of God, that you may keep your tradition. Verse 13, they were making the word of God of no effect through your tradition which you have handed down, and many such things you do. They were so focused on their traditions, which they thought guarded against breaking the Torah, that their traditions became gospel, in a sense. Right? Those were the things that you had to obey, that you had to comply with. So it's kind of no wonder then when you have Jesus Christ come along, who's teaching things that are contrary to the traditions, right? And here, and not only that, they taught that it was unacceptable for you to oppose anything that somebody who was older than you in age taught. So Jesus Christ coming along, here's this 30-year-old upending their whole system, preaching against their whole system. You can understand why they did not really think much of him. He was this upstart teaching all this crazy stuff that they had never heard before, as though he has the authority to teach it, right? And who is he to do that? Well, we know who he was, but they didn't believe that he was. Matthew 23 and verse 1. Matthew 23, verse 1. Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do. They were teaching things that were right. They had been given an understanding of truth, and they were teaching it. And they were teaching other stuff on top of it. But Jesus Christ says, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do, but do not do it according to their works. For they say and do not do. For they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But all their works they do to be seen by men. They did what they did to be seen. They did what they did because they had a very high opinion of themselves. They thought they knew all there was to know. They were going to teach it, right? And Jesus Christ calls them out and says, you do this to be seen. He calls out that form of hypocrisy. The thing was, they had words. They had the knowledge of God's way. But they did not do it. They didn't act on it. It's like they knew better, but they didn't do it. The Sadducees were a little bit of a different group. So the Sadducees were those who served in the temple. It was the high priest's family. It was those who were they were aristocrats. They were the people who operated in sort of the upper echelon of politics. They held political power. When the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, the Sadducees, the record of them disappears. Because there was no more temple, there was no more sort of political system that they needed to be ingrained with, and so that whole class just disappears, and so we actually know a lot less about them. Whereas the Pharisees, their tradition continues through today in the form of rabbinic Judaism. But the Sadducees, they served in the temples. They were political players, right? They operated with the Romans and sort of interacted with the Romans. You know, they were the Sanhedrin, that political, it was a political legal body, the one that judged Jesus Christ. That was Sadducees. They actually held that the Torah was binding and the oral traditions were not. They mostly rejected the oral traditions. So they held to the Torah, but a lot of it was because really those oral traditions made being political and working in that sphere really inconvenient. They kind of rejected those things. Matthew 22, verse 23. If you go back a little bit, Matthew 22 and verse 23. The same day the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him, and they tested him. So the Pharisees believed in a resurrection into the kingdom of the Messiah. The Sadducees did not believe that there was any resurrection like that. And so here they're coming and asking him about resurrection because he's taught about resurrection, and they're going to challenge him. But look at, we'll skip their whole argument. Look at what Jesus Christ says in verse 29. He says, "You're mistaken, not knowing the scriptures nor the power of God." He calls them out for not knowing what they should have known. He says, "You've got it all right in front of you. You believe the Torah. You believe that this is true. You believe that this is binding. But you don't know the scriptures or the power of God." And they should have. The third one that he calls out as leavened is actually an individual. It's Herod. This is the son of Herod the Great. So when Jesus Christ was born, you'll remember that Herod tried to have him killed and wipes out all the infants. That's Herod the Great. That's not the Herod who was ruling when Jesus Christ was ministering. Right? During his 3.5 years of ministry, that's Herod's son, Herod Antipas. Sometimes he's called Herod the Tetrarch. He inherited part of his father's territory, a quarter of it. That's what tetrarch means. And so he has a quarter of the territory. He ruled over the region of Galilee, which is, if you look at that map in the back of your book, and there's that little sea up above the where the Dead Sea is, right? He's up in that region. That was his region, and also a region called Perea, which was on the east side of the Jordan River. But up in the Sea of Galilee, he built his headquarters city, Tiberias, sort of on the southwest bank of the Sea of Galilee. Right? If the Sea of Galilee is kind of a big circle, he put his city is about like 8 o'clock on that circle. Capernaum is at about 12 o'clock on that circle. That's where Jesus Christ lived. That's where most of his ministry was. So Jesus Christ could look across the lake, right? And see. If you're standing there in Capernaum and you look across, you can see right where Tiberias would have been. It's a big lake, but it's not that big. So Jesus Christ would have known who this guy was. He would have seen his city. He would have seen what he had done. He was familiar with him. And Herod was very interested in Judaism. He had a lot of Jewish connections. Let's go over to Acts 13 and verse 1. We learn something sort of interesting, sort of sideways. There's this little comment dropped in here in Acts 13. Acts 13, 1 says, "Now in the church that was at Antioch, there were certain prophets and teachers, Barnabas, Simeon, who was called Niger, Lucius of Cyrene, and then notice this, Manaen, who had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch, and Saul." Manaen is a leader in the church there at Antioch. He had been raised with Herod the Tetrarch. So there's some connection here, right? He knows Herod. Herod is brought up with this guy, and now this guy is in the church, we would say. Right? And there was overlap, right? Their spheres overlap. They were probably brought up with a lot of knowledge of Judaism, and we see Manaen now a part of the church. So we know he's got some background that would connect with the Jews here. Let's go over to Mark chapter 6, verse 20. Mark 6 and verse 20. This is the account of John the Baptist being beheaded, but we get another little glimpse of Herod in here. It says, "Herod feared John." This is Mark 6 and verse 20. "Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man, and he protected him up until he killed him, but he protected him. And It also says, where are we? Verse 20. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. He liked to hear John. John the Baptist would come in, and we know that John the Baptist came in at one point and said, you shouldn't have your brother's wife. He had done this thing where his brother Philip, he really liked his wife and stole her away. And John called him out for it. John knew him well enough, was in his presence enough, right, to be able to say, you shouldn't have done that. And that's the thing that ended up getting him killed. But he liked to hear John. He liked when John would preach. He thought it was interesting. There were some good things there. Let's go over to Luke 23 and verse 7. There were good things there, and he knew it. Luke 23, verse 7. Verse 6, it says, when Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean. Here, this is Jesus Christ going through his trial and scourging. And Pilate finds out he's a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. Jerusalem is a good ways south of Galilee. Jerusalem is not in Galilee, and it's not in Perea. But Herod, for some reason, is in Jerusalem during the feast. Herod went down to the feast, right? We can't necessarily prove that he went down there to keep the feast, but it's very interesting that Herod is not in, he's not in this place because it's his region. He's down there where the Jews are keeping the feast. He knew about Judaism. He knew there was something really interesting going on here. He liked to hear about it. He had longed to have a conversation with Jesus Christ and to maybe see some sign or some miracle. He was very interested. But he didn't do anything with it. When we look at these three groups that Jesus says are leavened groups, he says there's hypocrisy there. We see that these groups, they all had knowledge of the way. They all had knowledge of the truth. They all knew about it, but they didn't act on it. They all had very high opinions of themselves. That was probably a bit of a barrier for them to actually do something with the knowledge that they had. And so they didn't. They didn't act on it. To know, to teach, but to not do is hypocrisy. And Jesus calls that leavening. That's what leavening looks like. What does unleavened look like? What does it look like to be unleavened? We can look in, the easy answer is to say, well, it looks like Jesus Christ. And that's correct, but it's not very specific. It's like, well, in what ways? How? Like, give me some details. What does that mean? I want to look at one way, at one facet of what it means to be unleavened. And I want to go over to Romans 12. This is where we're going to really focus most of our remaining time. Romans chapter 12. Okay, so we're going to jump in here, right? And Romans is one of the most technical, elaborate books in the Bible. Paul is he's writing to this group of people that he has not met, and he's trying to make this very structured case about Christianity. And so we're jumping into the middle of an impossibly complex chain of thought. But just know that from chapter 11 to chapter 12, there's this major shift. He's actually going from a lot of the conceptual stuff, the theoretical stuff that that he's really like proving his case, sort of almost legally going through and proving his case. And here in chapter 12, he's going to shift gears, and he's going to talk about what that looks like in your life. This is like the rubber hits the road part. And then what is that supposed to look like? Romans chapter 12, 1, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So he's begging them to be living sacrifices. There's a lot we could say about that, but really where I want to focus today is in verse 3. Romans 12, 3. For I say, through the grace given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. Here's where being unleavened starts, is with humility. Right? We begin with humility. It says, don't think of yourselves more highly than you ought to think. So that sort of begs the question then, well, how highly ought we to think of ourselves? How highly should we think? Because, I mean, it's not nothing, right? But how highly ought we to think? I think that this feast tells us that. Night to be tells us. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 16 and verse 3. Deuteronomy 16 and verse 3 tells us pretty much exactly how highly we ought to think of ourselves. You shall eat no leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread with it. That is the bread of affliction. For you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, that you may remember the day in which you came out of the land of Egypt, all the days of your life. That bread of affliction, that coming out of Egypt, all of that, these days remind us that we were slaves. That's really the answer for how highly we ought to think of ourselves. We're slaves. So we're not good for nothing. Right? A slave's not good for nothing. But as a slave, we're really not our own. Let's go over to Romans 6. Slave's a pretty harsh term with a lot of connotations today that are pretty rough. But Paul says it very clearly. Romans chapter 6, verse 16. He says, do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness. You're a slave to sin or you're a slave to righteousness. Those are your options. Bob Dylan says it really well. He says, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you got to serve somebody. You're a slave to something, to whatever you present yourself to obey. Slaves to sin, slaves to righteousness. That's how highly we ought to think of ourselves. We're bought at a price, right? We're told that. Jesus Christ's blood purchased us. We're bought. So we're not our own, right? But we're not purchased because we're without value. We're not purchased because we're nothing. God has made us something. He's made us something, right? We haven't made ourselves something, but he's made us something. So it's not our own doing that we are now something. We'll talk a little more about what that something is. Right? But he has made us something. So we can't claim it. We can't say, well, look at me. Look at what I can do. Because God gave that to us to be able to do whatever it is that we can do. God empowered that. And as we present ourselves as slaves to righteousness, right, then God can empower us to be whatever it is he wants us to be. But it's really not our doing. This is why it has to start with humility. Anytime Paul gets into the things that he's going to talk about here in Romans 12, he always couches it in terms of humility, of having this lowliness of mind. That's where we've got to start. Back in Romans 12:3, he says we need to think soberly. Right? Think soberly. This is very clearly about ourselves, right? With humility, like discerning our true state before God. Right? Think soberly. He doesn't say think of yourself as totally worthless, right? That's not humility. But thinking soberly, thinking humbly, is recognizing really what we are before God, which is without God, absolutely, we're dust. Right? But before God, he has called us for a purpose. He has made us something. And so because of that, we have to think soberly about this calling that we have. Continuing there in verse 3, as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. We're going to see here that he's going to talk more about this, about what God has given to each one of us, about what he's dealt to us. But before he gets into that, verse 4, he's going to remind us again. He's going to bring us back to humility. But verse 4, for as we have many members in one body, but all the members do not have the same function. So we, being many, are one body in Christ and individually members of one another. This is the lesson of Passover. When we take that bread, right? We read in 1 Corinthians, it says, you are one bread and one body. So Paul's sort of bringing that back to our recollection that, like, you have to recognize the body. We start from a humble place, recognizing what we are, and then recognizing that we are part of this body. And he uses this analogy several times, right? It's a familiar one. We're members one of another. We all have functions. Because we know we're members, we can maintain that humble perspective, right? Not thinking too much about ourselves, because we realize, well, I'm just a part of this whole thing, right? Me on my own, right? What am I doing, right? I mean, imagine any single one of your body parts just on its own, right? What's a liver just doing on its own? Really nothing. It's got nothing to filter, and it's not putting out anything, doing whatever else livers do, right? It's nothing, but it's essential in the body. We're all that way, right? You take us and you sever us and you put us out on our own, we're pretty worthless. It's very humbling in that sense. But in the body, playing our part, there's value there. It also means that we can see value in each other, because every other part contribute something. And we might think, well, I'm the heart of this thing, right? That's great. A heart's important, right? But what good's a heart without the lungs? Right? What good is any of it without any other part of it? And so we can look and we can say, ah, yes, I've got my part. All of us have some part in this, right? We have a function. And more than that, we have an obligation. We have an obligation to the other members of the body to function the way that we were designed to function so that the whole body works. Right? If the stomach just decides that it's not important anymore and it's going to stop processing food because, well, the heart's doing cool stuff and, you know, Those lungs do really neat things. That brain's pretty awesome. The eye is cool. And the stomach says, you know, I don't really have a part here. Well, now nothing gets nutrients, right? The stomach has an obligation to function. Every part has an obligation to the rest of the body to function in the way that it's designed to function. We can't look at ourselves as unnecessary, as superfluous, right, and neglect to do the thing that we've been designed to do. Also, we can't usurp some other function, right? The stomach says, well, I could also do what the heart does. Well, how's that going to work, right? It's not. The metaphor really helps us see our place in things, understand that we and everybody else in the body has value, and that we have an obligation to each other. With all of that context, then, you see, Paul gets into this idea of different gifts that we've been given. Romans 12:6. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them. Let's use them. It's interesting because the word here that he's got for gifts is the word charisma, right? Which we understand today is riz. Right? That's our thing. But the word charisma comes from the word charis, which is the word translated grace. It's a thing given. It's a thing bestowed. Right? Not earned, but a thing given. This list in here sometimes is called the charismata by commentators and theologians and people. It's the list of gifts. It's a list of gifts. Right? But these are things that are given by the grace of God. We see that, right? That's what we see in verse 6. Having then gifts, charisma, differing according to the grace, charis, that is given to us, let us use them. So these are the things that God in his grace gives to us individually. And that Paul says, use. We have to use them. Right? Using these gifts to edify the body, that's our obligation as slaves. That's kind of how he works this and wants us to think about it, right? It's that we have to be so humble of mind that we can recognize gifts that we have, not be puffed up by them, not be leavened by them, and recognize our obligation to use them for each other, to serve each other. He actually exemplifies this really well. If you look back at verse 3, Romans 12:3, for I say, through the grace given to me, right? So he's saying he's been given something, the grace given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself as more highly than he ought. What he's saying, he's exemplifying his own principle here. He's saying, I was given a gift of apostleship. That's the underlying message. He was given a gift of apostleship, and his obligation to them is to use it, to teach them, to encourage them, to spread this message. And he doesn't shy away from using it. But he's also not using it in a proud way. He's not using it in a way to puff himself up, right? You see him constantly giving the glory back to God and boasting about God. So just right here, packed in that little section, right, he's not only telling us what to do, but he's showing us how to do it. Right? Don't back down from the thing that God has called you to do, right? But do it humbly. Use it. My wife can't be here today. She's in Oklahoma. She's helping with her grandmother out there. So I'm going to tell a story about her. I asked her. She said it was okay. So at one point, I got my wife a gift. I gave her a gift. And she opened it, and she looked at me and said, do you still have the receipt? Now, I knew this was a possibility when I got the gift, to be fair. I knew that maybe she's not going to want to keep this. And she didn't want to keep it. And so it was very good because I took it back and that was fine. That was the perfect response, right? When you give a gift, you want to know that the recipient of that gift is going to use it or appreciate it if it's not a thing to be used, right? But you want to know that that person is going to take that gift and use that gift, right? If I had given my wife this gift and she said, oh, that's such a sweet thought, and then put it on a shelf somewhere and never touched it, right? What's the point of that? At least have her go take it back and get some money for it and go get something that you will use, right? But to give a gift and just have it be unused, why? What's the point of that, right? God doesn't give us gifts to make us feel good about ourselves, right? He gives us gifts because he expects us to take them and use them, right? There's a whole parable about it, right? The guy goes and buries it in the ground and here it is, right? It's like, why would you do that? Just tell me to take it back. I'll go find somebody who will use it. You know, I'll get a different gift for you that's gonna work for you. God expects us to use the gifts that he gives us. Let's look at some of these. This is not an exhaustive list right here. Verses 6 through 8, he identifies some gifts. These are maybe things that he knows about the congregation in Rome that he's going to say, these are some things that you all have. But this is not the exhaustive list because he has lists elsewhere where he has other things like tongues and healings and apostleship as gifts given through God's grace. And those aren't in this list. So this isn't meant to be the authoritative, definitive, you know, just these items kind of list. But it helps us to understand things about our own gifts, the things that God has given to us. The first one he lists here is prophecy. With a lot of these, he doesn't only say that here is a gift, here's a thing, but he talks about how to use it, how to exercise it, because again, he's expecting them to use them. He's saying, use the gifts. Having then different gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them. If prophecy, let us prophesy in proportion to our faith. Prophecy here is not primarily about foretelling the future, although it doesn't exclude that. But it's really about speaking under inspiration in order to build up the church according to one's faith, right? In proportion to one's faith. That's what he's talking about with prophecy there. Those who are able to do that should do that. Sometimes that means in a formal capacity here, but sometimes that can be personal interactions. Right? Those who are able to, under the inspiration of God's Spirit, right, provide the encouragement that to build people up. Prophecy really, in this sense and other uses, it sort of implies some sort of revelation, not necessarily revelation in a new sense, but revelation of biblical principles, right? Exposing things, uncovering things, prophesying in that sense, being able to show people things, serving. Verse 7, in the New King James, it says ministry, right? Let us use it in our ministering. That word ministry there just is a very general term that means serving. Means serving. Here it seems to apply within the body. He's talking in the context of the body, and it really seems to be applied to the body, serving others in the body. Ministering to the material needs of believers is the way that Expositor's Bible Commentary says it. Some people compare this to the word helps in 1 Corinthians, where it's something that it's general in the sense of being able to help other members as you see need. Some people are very good at that. Some people know something's off with this person. I wonder if I could help out. Right? Some people just have, they're tapped into sort of the network, and they know when somebody's going to need to help with this thing over here. They've got this project over there and could use some help with, right? Serving, attending to needs in that form, right? Teaching. This is primarily about God's way, teaching. Sharing knowledge, sharing wisdom with clarity. Encouraging. He who exhorts in exhortation. That this is an interesting word that can mean, it can mean comfort. It can mean encouragement in the sense that we think of encouragement, or it can mean exhortation. Right? And sort of anything along that spectrum, depending on the context that it's in. Right? And sometimes it means all of those, right? Say somebody shows up one Sabbath and they're looking a little sad, and you say, "Well, what's going on?" "Oh, my goldfish died yesterday." "Oh, I'm sorry to hear that," right? Providing some comfort, right? And then they show up the next Sabbath and they look really sad, and you say, "What's got you down?" And they're like, "Well, my goldfish, you know, I just really miss that goldfish." And you say, "Well, I understand that, but you know, you could get another goldfish, right? Encourage them. Good to get another goldfish." Now, next Sabbath they show up and they're still down, and you're like, "Oh, what's going on now?" And that goldfish was just so special. Right? Now it might be time to exhort. "Hey, this is three Sabbaths in a row. You've come in here with the cloud over your head. It might be time to move on from the goldfish. Get a cat." Right, so there's sort of that spectrum that this word can really mean, right? And some people are good at that, and we need that. Sometimes all of us need somebody to tell us to forget about the goldfish. He who gives with liberality. Giving is, you know, really giving, this word is sharing, essentially sharing the blessings that God has given you with other people. He gives, God, this is one of those gifts that God gives to some people, gives them an abundance. And some people are really good at just sharing it. He says, if this is your thing, do it. And he says, do it with liberality. That word means with simplicity, like with singleness of mind, with no ulterior motives, no other intent, just that simple giving. No regret, right? If we can't give without regretting, it's like, "Oh, here, take this out of my hand," right? We shouldn't. That's not the kind of giving he's talking about. He's saying give simply, liberally, without motive. Leading. He who leads with diligence. Leading. The word means to stand before others, and it can mean in a formal sense or in a position or in a role. But that same word is also applied to husbands and to fathers, heads of household. It says, do it with diligence. And those of us who have children living in our house, we can lead for a time, and then at some point, you no longer get to lead. They grow up. It's a phase. It's a period, right? And so during that period that we have opportunity to lead, we lead as best we can with diligence. It says, all those who lead in any sort of role, any sort of capacity, there's a diligence that has to accompany that, recognizing, again, the obligation to the body. Last one here, he who shows mercy. This is not talking about being really good at forgiving, right? Just trying to get people to offend you so that you can forgive them. It's not talking about that. It's not talking about being sparing in judgment, right? Being merciful in that sense. It's really the word here seems to be especially about ministering to the sick and the needy. Caring for those who who are in that place where they need it, right? Showing mercy, showing compassion to them. And it says, when you do that, do it cheerfully. Most of these gifts should probably be used cheerfully. God gives gifts very thoughtfully, right? More thoughtfully than I gave my gift to my wife that I took back. Right? God gives gifts to us very thoughtfully. He distributes them by his Spirit, right, as he sees fit, for knowing what's going to be the best fit for us, right? Knowing our strengths, weaknesses, knowing where we can play a role, knowing how we can best contribute to the body. But he's giving these things to us, expecting us to use them. Romans 12 and verse 9. Let love be without hypocrisy. This is that leaven that Jesus identified. Let love be without hypocrisy. Sort of sums up a lot of what we've really been talking about. Let love be without hypocrisy. If you know to do, then do. Let's go down to verse 16. Romans 12 and verse 16. Be of the same mind toward one another. This literally means have equal regard for one another. So regard others equally, recognizing that God is working in every person that he has called. And we can recognize that in them, regard that in them, right? To disregard that is to disregard the work of God. We need to regard others as those that God is working with, as those that God is doing something in, that God is working in. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. When you associate with the humble, you actually, it's like you deprive the arrogant of attention, actually. Right? And the arrogant, the conceited, they need that attention. He says, don't hang out with them. Don't give that to them. Associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion. This is the Pharisees' problem. This is the Sadducees' problem. This is Herod's problem. Being very wise in their own opinion, being very high-minded, thinking very much of themselves. Now, the problem with this message, the problem with this verse, is that generally the people who need it the most hear it the least, right? Because we do all sorts of interesting things when somebody tells us, don't be high-minded, don't be conceited, don't have a high opinion of yourselves. Here are things that I do. Let's say I've done these things in the past, hopefully in the long past. Right? But when we hear this kind of message, it says, don't be high-minded. Sometimes we go, oh, I know exactly who needs to hear this message. I've got someone in mind. Or we say, well, that's really not my problem. I know my problems. That one's not my problem. Right? But then our actions will betray us, right? I'll think, oh, well, I don't think so much of myself. But then I'll be in a conversation and I'll talk over other people because I feel like my opinion needs to be heard. Right, and my ideas need to be shared, and my views need to be, bestowed on others. Right, and then you walk away from that conversation. You go, oh, maybe I thought really highly of myself there. Right? Sometimes we hear this message, and we think, well, we've got all sorts of ways to rationalize it, because we can say, well, I get it, I shouldn't think so highly of myself in certain areas, but you know, I'm in this role, I'm in this position, I have this gift, I have this thing, right? And so it's okay for me to be a little more, you know, out there about this other thing, right? After all, I'm in charge of this. And so, you know, it's kind of natural for me to be able to be a little bit more puffed up about it. We don't tell ourselves that, right? But that's kind of what we do. We make exceptions for ourselves sometimes. The other thing that we do, and I'm sure we know people who did this to Paul, right? As Paul says, don't be so high-minded. Don't think so highly of yourself. People say, who are you to tell me that, Paul? You used to murder people. You were a Pharisee. You can't tell me that. I remember being at camp. I think it's been over a decade now, so it's safe. It's far enough away. I remember being at camp one year, and they would let the campers speak on the Sabbath. And one of the campers got up to speak about something. I don't actually remember what he spoke about. I gave a split sermonette. It was a speech. It was like 6 minutes. And he got up and he told us what he was going to speak about. And I thought to myself, oh, that's cute. Who is this, you know, 16-year-old to talk to me about whatever? And then it turns out it was probably exactly the thing that we all needed to hear. Sometimes we do that where we say, well, the messenger is too young, is too old, is too, you know, crazy, right? Is too short. And we do these things where we say, I don't need to pay attention to that message because it was given by that person. And so then we really discount the principle, right? We miss out in that sense, right? So I guess that's just my caution to say, if you feel like this message doesn't apply to you, maybe you're wrong. If you feel like this message applies to you, you might be wrong too, actually, but you might have some of that humility stuff working for you. Philippians 2 and verse 5. Philippians 2 and verse 5. So when I think about what does being unleavened look like, this is it. This is the pinnacle of it. But I didn't want to go here until we had talked through some of those other things, because I really feel like this captures and sums up all of that stuff just in a beautiful way. Philippians 2, 5. Let this mind be in you, which also is in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but he made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant, of a slave. And coming in the likeness of men, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. He did all of these things, right? He humbled himself, and then he came as a slave with all the gifts that he was given as a human, and served his heart out. That's what we've been called to do. Romans 12 and verse 5. Romans 12, 5 says, so we being many are one body in Christ. Right? That's what we celebrate at Passover. That's what these days remind us. So we are this one bread, this one body that he's called out, called to be slaves of righteousness, called to serve him. And not only that we're one body, not just that we're his body, but individually members of one another. When we think about these days, and we think about leavening, and we think about hypocrisy, there's a certain kind of hypocrisy that's obvious, right? It's to go out and do the good-looking things, to stand and pray on the street corners and make your phylacteries broad, whatever that means. Jesus Christ said that's what the Pharisees did. And they did all these things to be seen by men, right? But they weren't actually doing what was right. That's sort of an obvious hypocrisy, is to go do the visible but be something else behind closed doors. There's a less obvious hypocrisy, right? And that's to know what to do, to know to edify the body, to know that you have a part, to know that you have a role, and to not do it. Jesus Christ set us an example as really that unleavened slave, right? He humbly came and he gave up any claim to himself. He very willingly, very cheerfully gave of everything that he had in order to build up the body. Let's use this Holy Day season to reflect on our place in that body as members of one another and make sure we're doing our part to edify it.